It sounds easy, right? Just leave China if you're an American company. Well, no, it doesn't, but that's kind of the point, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 26th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Our lead story today straddles the line between can he do that and what would happen if he did that. That, in this case, being, as President Trump did on Friday, hereby ordering all American companies to start looking for alternatives to China. The president says something called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act gives him the authority to do that. So we called up Raj Bala. He's a professor at the University of Kansas School of Law to ask, A, what is the IEEPA?
This is an act that Congress passed in 1977 to deal with unusual and extraordinary threats to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States.
And then question B, which went to Judith Ann Lee, the co-chair of the international trade practice at the law firm Gibson Dunn. Question B was, can he do this?
We have never seen any president use it kind of as leverage in a trade dispute with another country.
Usually it's used to prosecute things like drug trafficking or terrorism financing with sanctions or other economic punishments. Now, to be clear, the president can and past presidents have sign executive orders invoking this law. But forcing American businesses to move out of China, what would that even look like? We called Mary Lovely. She's with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
So I really think we have to divide companies into two different types.
Okay.
Those who import and export a lot to China.
Basically, companies that don't necessarily sell their final product in China, although a lot of them do, we should say. But the Chinese manufacturing base is a critical part of their supply chain. Apple comes to mind. That is category one.
And then you have companies that are mainly producing in China for China.
Starbucks, for instance. Boeing as well. So let's break them down. Most of Apple's products are, as you know, made in China. The Chinese company Foxconn is its biggest assembler. So moving out of China?
It would be an unprecedented disruption to the overall supply chain.
That's Dan Ives at Wedbush Securities. He figures it would take years and be unbelievably expensive for Apple to completely leave China. And oh, by the way, that would just clear the way for competitors like, I don't know, Samsung to move in. Boeing, it opened a finishing plant for the 737 MAX in China back in 2018, designed to help deliver more than 200 new planes to Chinese airlines before the grounding of the 737 MAX, that is. David Primos at the University of Rochester.
In the short run, I mean, the clear winner would be Airbus.
Airbus, Boeing's biggest and really only rival, competes heavily with Boeing in the Chinese market. Long story short, though, for Apple and Boeing and dozens, maybe hundreds of other companies, just up and leaving China isn't something they can afford to do. Boeing declined to comment, by the way. Apple and Starbucks just didn't get back to us. All right, a slight turn now to the markets and the president and the global economy and what is going on. We got Josh Brown on the phone to talk about that. He's the CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management. Josh, welcome to the program.
Great to talk to you, Kai.
So go back, I suppose, to Friday with me. There was the back and forth between the president and China. There was the president taken off again after Jay Powell, and then his tweets about ordering companies out of China. And the markets promptly said, forget it, and gave up 2-3%. Why? What happened?
I think that the markets are picking up on something that maybe the political media has been saying for a long time, which is that there really isn't any rhyme or reason to much of what we see and hear each day. And it's not just that the tweets seem to have gotten wilder and more unhinged. It's that there are now more of them. Hmm. There's also not really much gravitas coming from the president's economic or financial advisors. These are not people that have had careers on Wall Street. They're mostly people that have come from the media. So I think that exacerbates the volatility that you're referring to.
Okay, so let's get to this morning then. The president at the G7 in Biarritz says, China called, everything's going to be fine. And the futures market went, oh, look, everything's fixed. So
I'm not sure that that's actually what happened. The president lies almost all the time. And so I don't think the market, when we say the market, what we're doing is we're anthropomorphizing something that is really mechanical at this point. So you've got people that have big positions on where they're betting against the market because they think things will get worse. And then a tweet goes out that 1,000 different software programs read as being positive. And so technically a lot of buying comes in from these algorithms that are software programs. What you're witnessing is not the average market participant feeling like there's some kind of a relief. That's actually not at all what's going on. There are technical reasons why even in a downtrending market, there are some really big up days. It's not, it doesn't always have a one for one linear explanation. Like you would find in a storybook where everyone lives happily ever after.
So look, with the caveat that of course you should not check your 401k statement every single day or week or even month, really. If you're not Josh Brown, but you're somebody in, you know, middle America someplace trying to get by, what do you make of the signals that, you know, to anthropomorphize it again, the market is sending?
I think that there should be a lot of humility, and especially on the part of professionals, not just a regular person, let's say, in quote-unquote middle America. In the case of 99.99% of people currently listening to my voice, the best thing to do is often nothing. No unforced errors is probably how they should be feeling. And they should not be trying to ask themselves, okay, the president just tweeted this and then China just denied it. What's the trade? That is a losing question. The longer we can stay invested and not make mistakes, the better things will be, even if they seem really dark or confusing at any given moment like they do right now.
The voice of Josh Brown. He's the CEO of Ritholtz Wealth Management in New York. You can see him on CNBC as well. Josh, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
Wall Street on this Monday. As I said, everything's fine. Or as Josh said, the algorithms sure think so. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've ever bought or sold a house, you've probably been through an appraisal. Somebody comes, does a bunch of measuring, takes a bunch of pictures, goes away, and then emails you their educated guess about what they think the house is worth. Federal regulations say you got to have an appraisal if the mortgage is more than $250,000, but there is a new proposed rule that would raise that threshold to $400,000 because, well, I mean, inflation is part of this story. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
The current threshold of $250,000 was set in 1994, and home values have gone up a lot since then. So regulators thought it was time for an update. But Andrew Pizer with the National Consumer Law Center disagrees.
I think it's a really bad idea. Appraisal problems can certainly hurt consumers and can harm the economy as a whole.
The rule doesn't apply to loans that are made or backed by government agencies like the FHA or VA or by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But according to regulators, about 40% of home sales would be affected. Jennifer Wagner with Mountain State Justice, a legal advocacy group, especially worries about vulnerable home buyers who might end up borrowing more than the home is worth.
What this does is put those communities, lower income, rural communities and communities of color at higher risk of predatory lending because it doesn't keep those same safeguards in place that are now being limited only to the most wealthy amongst us.
Richard Cordray is former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He opposed this measure when it came up a few years ago.
I think it introduced a bit more risk, but I also don't think it's an earth-shattering risk that's going to upset the mortgage market significantly.
And it could make the home buying process a lot smoother. Lenders will still need to assess the home's value somehow. And real estate consultant Mike Delpretti says data and technology have made it a lot easier to do that accurately.
For consumers, you speed up the process, you reduce costs. And you just, you know, reduce pain points and friction in an already pretty painful and frictionful process.
And even if an appraisal isn't required, you can always request one. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We're going to take a turn to pharmaceuticals now for a story in which the dollar amounts get very, very big. There is a big merger in the works. You might have heard of this one. Bristol-Myers Squibb plans to buy Celgene for $74 billion, which is, yes, a very big dollar amount, but not the amount of which I speak. There's news today that to clear government antitrust hurdles and seal the deal, Celgene is going to unload its top-selling psoriasis drug. It's called Otezla. It's going to sell it to Amgen for $13.4 billion. And remember, this is for one drug. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looks into what's going on there.
Otezla is an oral medication designed to treat the chronic skin disease psoriasis and a related form of arthritis that affect more than 9 million Americans. Otezla's annual sales have been growing by double digits. Initial estimates of the price Celgene might get for Otezla were around $10 billion. Amgen's paying more than $13. Damian Conover follows Big Pharma at Morningstar.
I think it's a relatively fair price. It's a very high-margin drug.
List price is $3,398 for a 30-day supply, though most patients with insurance pay a tiny fraction of that. One reason Otezla commanded such a high price, it won't come off patent until 2028, so Amgen gets an effective monopoly, no generics, for nearly a decade. Plus, says Rice University economist Vivian Ho,
there are things they could do. They could change the amount of the dosage.
Or make small changes to the formulation to extend its exclusivity even longer, a standard practice in the industry. But what about new drugs that could compete? Bristol's got its own psoriasis treatment in the pipeline. J.B. Silvers studies healthcare policy at Case Western Reserve.
You can have multiple competitors, and prices don't really drop that much. It's not a price-sensitive market the way that most commodities are.
Amgen told us in an email it expects the market for Otezla to grow as it's approved for more uses. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's a storm in the Atlantic that people who know about these kinds of things are keeping an eye on. Tropical storm Dorian is getting stronger, maybe turning into a hurricane in a couple of days and moving toward Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico that is still heavily in debt and dealing with infrastructure damage from Hurricane Maria 2 years ago. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
Meteorologists expect Dorian to hit the southwestern part of Puerto Rico in the coming days. Charles Venature Santiago teaches political science at the University of Connecticut. He's a Puerto Rican native with a lot of family on the island. He says people with the means are stocking up on water and canned food. But that's not most Puerto Ricans.
60% of the population are still living in poverty. They're relying on disability services. They just don't have the resources to prepare to respond to this crisis.
Another issue, the cash-strapped authorities haven't been able to provide funding to fix the heavily damaged electrical grid or the water system destroyed by Hurricane Maria. Gary Webb teaches disaster management at the University of North Texas. He says on the positive side, FEMA still has an active presence on the island, so there are some people and resources available. But
the occurrence of another major disaster could really disrupt the ongoing recovery process and offset any gains that have been made.
And not everyone has agreed on the reconstruction effort. Right now, housing is being rebuilt in many areas still susceptible to disasters. Some say that's crazy. Gary Webb says convincing some residents of that is no easy task.
It may sound reasonable to say we're going to solve the problem by moving people out of harm's way. In reality, that's a very difficult proposition.
Because moving is something only those with means can consider. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Stir and Shaken are brilliantly named acronyms.
Interestingly, though, not about how James Bond likes his martinis. Robocalls, straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 269 today, 1%, closed at 25,898. The NASDAQ added 101, 1.3%, 7,853. The S&P 500 up 31 points, 1%, 28,078. Companies likely to be affected by tariffs moved higher because, as the president said, China called. Plane maker Boeing climbed 0.8% today. Apple polished up 1.8%. Chipmaker Intel gained 1.3% today. NVIDIA clicked up about 1.8% on the day. Bristol-Myers Squibb, we told you about, it was up 3.2%. Celgene, also up 3.2%. That was in Mitchell Hartman's story. Dish Network beamed up 3.9% today after a ratings upgrade from an analyst at brokerage firm Raymond James. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.54%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The twists and turns of trade policy have been bewildering for a good long while now. But perhaps nothing could top the last 72 hours. Chinese retaliation, presidential twittering, American re-retaliation. Then today from the G7 in Brits, as I was telling Josh, the president saying without specifics or confirmation from the Chinese that Beijing called, literally called, and said it wants a deal. All of that is complicated enough for regular people to follow, but imagine you're a customs broker and tariff schedules are literally your job, and then stuff like this happens. That is Gretchen Blau. She's a customs broker we talk to every now and then. She's in Erie, Pennsylvania. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
So I'll tell you what, we've wanted to call you for a little while now because obviously tariff news. And then Friday happened and the weekend happened and we said, now we got to get Gretchen on the phone. Has your phone been ringing off the hook the last couple of 3 days?
Oh, yeah. Got some emails first thing this morning basically asking, is this really going to happen? And you have to explain that a tweet is not necessarily a policy that's carved in stone yet. And then this morning, word that the U.S. and China are back at the talks table. Uh-huh. So from one day to the next, it changes.
What kinds of questions are they asking? Is it about like when to ship stuff or how should I categorize this piece of, you know, equipment or whatever?
Well, kind of all of the above. What list is my stuff falling on? Because it's kind of confusing this time with the list 4A that takes place September 1st, and then there's the list 4B, December 15th.
Right. We should explain that's the actual, that's the actual header on the list. It's number 4A, right? So we're in like the fourth round and we're splitting it umpteen different ways.
Right. As an example, there's clothing items on both lists. So it depends on the specifications of the different clothing items as to which list it's on. So that gets a bit confusing for people. Same with some food products and whatnot. LED screens and that type of thing. There's some on each list. So it's very difficult for importers to understand exactly what's going on and when they're going to be affected.
Drill down a little bit, right? Because even the tiniest variations in a product or some kind of produced good can put it on one list or the other, right?
Exactly. I don't have the exact specifications, right, but shoes as an example. Yeah. Just the type of sole can make a difference. The type of upper can make a difference. What kind of stitching is on it? That type of thing can make a difference as to how it's classified and therefore what list it's on.
So which list it's on, that affects which set of tariffs it hits, right? Either 1 September or 15 December, right?
Yes, that's correct.
You ever seen anything like this, by the way? You've been doing this a while, I imagine.
I've been doing it a while, but I've never seen anything like this. And I really like being able to give my customers definitive answers. And I haven't been able to do that in a year or two now. Anytime someone asks me something, I said, well, this is where it stands right now, but that could change at any minute. And I mean, that's the absolute truth.
All right. So I have to ask you this as a trained customs professional. Is this going to mess up my Christmas shopping?
Yes, exactly.
No, I'm totally serious. It is?
Yeah, I mean, everything's going to get passed along to the consumer, so everyone's going to pay a little bit more. And if you don't get your Christmas shopping done by December 15th, then you're kind of out of luck. I'm kind of a last-minute shopper myself, so this year I'm not going to be. I'm going to plan a bit ahead on things in order to make sure I get the best price available.
Gretchen Blau, she is the customs brokerage manager at Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania. Gretchen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We mentioned on Friday that deal the big phone companies have made with state attorneys general, promising to do something about all those spam calls we've been getting, because, come on, we're all getting them, right? By one estimate, half of all calls to mobile phones are now robocalls. And I know what you're thinking here. Caller ID, just don't answer the phone. But what about the calls that seem to come from what should be a trustworthy caller? Or the latest trick, calls that seem to come from your local area code, because robocallers know you're more likely to answer if you think it might be, say, a doctor or the kid's school. Yeah? Well, au contraire, Marketplace's Jack Stewart looks at the history and the future of caller ID.
When telephone companies started introducing caller ID in the late 80s, they pushed it in TV ads as something worth paying extra for. You plugged in a small box with a screen next to your landline, and hey, you could catch those pesky kids red-handed.
555-3298. By the way, is your mother there?
By letting you see the number of who's calling, it can help you stop prank calls. Call for a free service connection.
Caller ID was introduced to kind of solve this problem of, hey, you know, folks would really like to know who's calling them.
Adam Dupay from Arizona State University says caller ID has now become a way for people to fake who's calling you. The data containing the outgoing number is attached to the call in an insecure way. That wasn't a big issue until the internet came along and enabled people to make calls from computers using voice over IP, or VoIP. And it's ridiculously easy to disguise your identity. I found a website that would give me 45 calling minutes for $10. I typed in the number I wanted to appear to be calling from and was given a code to dial, which I then used to fool my poor editor.
Hey, Betsy.
It worked. It's Jack.
Oh, it says Betsy's calling me.
I know. I spoofed my number.
Oh.
This is a super low-scale version of what scammers do en masse. It's why you get calls that appear to be from the IRS in Washington, D.C. around tax season, demanding your personal details. Or calls that seem to come from your own area code, but which actually originate overseas. Karen Panetta is an IEEE fellow at Tufts University. She says internet phone calls have never benefited from the same security protocols we have for other parts of our online lives.
When we went to the internet, we have lots of security and encryption. But somehow when voice over IP came along, they didn't carry those same types of safety or encryption rules with them. And now there's no verification.
She has all the calls that go to her 90-year-old parents, two cell phones, and their landline redirected to her so that she can screen them.
I would say 99% of all the calls that come in for them are scammers or robocalls.
232,000 complaints were filed in 2018.
That's Ajit Pai, chair of the FCC, which held a very well-attended summit to discuss the problem in July.
I've myself got one on the way into work this morning. Amazing how many free Marriott vacations I've won. I'm a very lucky person.
There could be a solution to all of this coming soon. Adam Dupay's team at Arizona State is one of many in academia and industry looking at fixes. He says the widely agreed solution is one called Secure Telephone Identity Revisited and Signature-Based Handling of Asserted Information Using Tokens, or STIR-SHAKEN.
STIR and SHAKEN are brilliantly named acronyms that describe protocols for how you can add authentication to a caller ID.
Every call gets a secure certificate saying it really is coming from the number it claims to be. As users, we'd probably see something like a green checkmark on our screens for verified calls. Jimmy Garvert manages the caller identity program at Neustar, which is helping carriers test how to make STIR SHAKEN work.
There is a real momentum being built that's going to help provide the tools required to help mitigate and eventually stop some of these bad robocalls from happening.
And just maybe make caller ID live up to that 80s potential. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today, in which a $500 million judgment against him is actually good news for Johnson & Johnson. This afternoon, a federal judge in Oklahoma ruled that J&J contributed to the opioid addiction crisis in that state and ordered the company to pay $572 million in damages. This was the first of more than 2,000 opioid cases to go to trial. J&J has promised it's going to appeal. The $500 million judgment works out pretty well for the company. Oklahoma had been asking for as much as $17 billion. Investors thought so, too. J&J shares jumped 4% after hours when the verdict was announced. Settled down a little bit after that, though. All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrials up 269 points, 1%. NASDAQ up 101 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 up 31 points. That is 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.